Up next, we're going to be talking about the incredible stories of Sasquatch. The name of the work is In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond by John Zada, and he's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. John Zada with us, a writer, photographer, journalist drawn to stories about adventure in far-flung parts of the planet. He has worked in more than two dozen countries, spent years as a journalist in the Middle East. His work has appeared in such publications as the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, CBC, Al Jazeera, and the BBC. And here he is on Coast to Coast with his work in the Valley of the Noble Beyond in search of the Sasquatch. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
You too. I got to ask you a little bit about your work in the Middle East with this tension between Iran and so many other countries. What do you think is going to happen there? What's your gut tell you?
My sense is generally that the two countries don't really want to go to war. And I haven't really been doing a lot of work on the Middle East recently. That was more in the past, and I did live out in the region in Dubai. I did work as a documentary filmmaker out in the region for about 5 years, and I was doing some war correspondent type of work, like, again, not so much in a news capacity, but more in a sort of longer form doc TV for an Arabic language news station. So I was actually there when sort of the first beginnings of the tension over the nuclear issue began. And then when I came back to Canada, I started to get into more print and writing and, you know, photography and travel and that kind of thing. And I guess that was partly as a result of spending so much time out there. And you know, when you work in a place like the Middle East, it's an extremely demanding, difficult job with all the travel. It's really stressful. And I think I realized when I came back that I had, you know, not really seen or done a lot of Canada-related stuff. And so I think that was the catalyst for me to get, you know, get into the travel writing and becoming a freelancer. You kind of have to do a little bit of everything. And so I just basically started to do assignments all over Canada and go to, like, you know, remote places and sort of do adventure stuff. And that's been the work that has, you know, segued and led, you know, into the book that I have just written. And you know, again, because freelance journalism is, you know, is not such a lucrative thing, and you have to be versatile. I've been doing a lot of, you know, news work, and I work as a writer at CBC, and worked at Al Jazeera in Doha, and so that's sort of the more meat and potatoes work that I've been doing as of late.
And it's much better to be a travel writer than to be doing some of those things before, huh?
For sure. And I mean, it's very different. It's a, you know, different kind of work. I think the travel writing, it doesn't have to necessarily be, you know, the fluff pieces, the spa write-ups, the hotel reviews, that kind of thing that you tend to associate with travel writing. And for me, because I started off in the Middle East, and because I have this, you know, connection with the news pegs and the more difficult stories and that kind of thing, you can still do travel writing and have a more serious angle. And I've gone to, you know, Northern Iraq and to Eastern Turkey to do, you know, write about, you know, the Kurds and Kurdistan. I've gone to Sarajevo in Bosnia and done, you know, like at the anniversary of the end of the war. What's it like to visit the city after the end of the war, or, you know, to New Orleans, 10th anniversary after Hurricane Katrina. So there are lots and lots of ways that you can still do material, do work that is a little bit lighter, yet at the same time does root you in, you know, more serious issues, into culture, into news pegs, into that kind of stuff. And I mean, it does also, I mean, to be honest, it does have its drawbacks. And
sure,
like, you know, travel writing isn't this
it's not all glamour.
That's a dream. It's you have to travel, you've got to deal with, like, lost luggage, you have to deal with difficult situations at borders. You're by yourself a lot. You can't bring people with you. And of course, you know, maybe the most difficult thing is to be traveling in a place, but you have to work, right? And you're kind of on the hunt, you're on the prowl. You have to do interviews, you're taking pictures, you're kind of watching, you're looking over your shoulder all the time. And so it's still not a kind of a dream gig, but it's fun.
It is fun indeed. Well, how did you evolve into the book, of course, in the valleys of the noble beyond? How did that occur?
Well, I mean, I guess we have to go back a little bit earlier, or a lot earlier, and it really began with my interest in Sasquatch. And as a lot of people can, a lot of the listeners can maybe relate to, I grew up in the 70s. I was a kid in the 70s, and the environment, the cultural milieu was very much Sasquatch imbued, and there was a spike in interest in the topic. And I grew up watching the $6 Million Man movies and TV series rather, and movies about the Sasquatch, and like it was basically everywhere. And being this impressionable young man who lived in a suburb of Toronto, you get sucked in basically, right? And so I think what really did it though was when my mom used to take me to the public libraries, and it was the books that hooked me. So probably at the age of 7 or 8 or whatever, I went to the library, found the mystery section, and just saw all these Sasquatch books. And one of the books, one of the authors who was publishing at the time was a guy by the name of John Green, who was probably the first journalistic Sasquatch investigator, the first guy to write these compendium of books of reports. And so, and I became a really, really proficient reader at a fairly young age, and I just it might have been a bit later, maybe 8 or 9, but I took out his books and I got completely enthralled. And so his books led to other books, John Napier's books about the Abominable Snowman, and Peter Burns, and eventually I kind of became this, like a young, enthusiast slash, pseudo expert on the subject. And I think what really added to that interest was, I grew up in the suburbs, and there was a green belt in my neighborhood, like a ravine and all this sort of forest and everything. And I ended up playing in those areas as a kid, and the combination of knowing about this, myth, legend, thing that's happening in, other parts of the continent, and having this green belt, it really kind of made me want to go out and see these other places, these mountainous areas of the Pacific Northwest and that kind of thing. And that was the sort of, the setup to what was to later come, essentially.
And we know that UFO cases are abundant on the Pacific Northwest, and Bigfoot cases are the same, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, that whole region, I think historically, has had numerous reports, and it's, I guess, the mountainous nature of the region, the fact that people like settlers arrived there, later and hadn't really, cut down all the forests like has happened on the East Coast. And so, and you've got a lot of, indigenous people who, were living in and continue to live out there with a lot of, myths and beliefs and things related to that. And so, yeah, I mean, it seems to be the epicenter of activity in the continent, although we know that Pennsylvania and Ohio and Texas, I mean, pretty much the phenomenon has essentially not spread, but I mean the reports have sort of come out now all over the continent.
Many cases indeed. Have you ever had your own Bigfoot experience, John?
I'm not sure. Well, I mean, there was something that did happen back in 1998. I traveled to the town of Nelson in British Columbia to visit a friend who had just moved out there. And Nelson is located in a place, in a region of British Columbia. It's in the southern part of the of the province. In the interior, it's in an area of the, called the Kootenays, and they, you know, they have reports. They have quite a bit of reports, and I think even the area across the border in the U.S. has got a lot of reports as well. And so at the time, I wasn't really aware that that area was a hotspot. And so it was the winter, and we, you know, I was just there for a week hanging out with my buddy and everything, and we decided to go for a hike one afternoon. And it was like an overcast day. It was snowing a little bit, and we, there was a trail that followed these railroad tracks, you know, around, you know, the side of a mountain above the town. And we were alone, and there was no one on the trail. And we were about an hour or an hour and a half into the hike. We'd stopped to you know, dig into some snacks and everything. And all of a sudden, we had heard, we'd heard these, I guess, footsteps on the mountain above us and behind us, and this sort of like crunch, 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 crunch from a distance. And at first, we didn't really think of anything of it. It cut, you know, might have been somebody approaching from the trail. And but as we, you know, as we waited to see what it was, it you know, got louder and louder and louder and louder. And there was a kind of a breathing with each step. It was like, shh, shh, oh, and it got so loud. And this is the really interesting part. When it finally kind of reached us, just above, you know, above us on the mountainside, into the trees, like it almost sounded like it was so close. It, you know, we should have been able to see it. We couldn't see it. There wasn't even any movement in the trees. There, like the snow on the branches weren't falling, and it just walked right by. And so we just kind of looked at each other, and we were sort of like, wow, that, like, what was that? Yeah. And then about, you know, 2 minutes in, it started coming back again. Like, it sounded like agitated, like it was carrying some weight on its shoulders, or it was like just...
And you could hear it rustling around, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and because there was snowpack, it was a kind of a crunching as well, right? But it was definitely a kind of a bipedal walking, you know, step-by-step, two-step kind of motion. And we were really afraid, and we instinctively ran back in the direction that we came as soon as we heard it come back, because the first time it came around, it was a really, really strong presence. And of course, it could have been an animal, it could have been some kind of a large, you know, I don't know, like an elk or a moose or something, but it didn't sound that way. And we just got so freaked out, and we just took off back down the trail. And so that was my, I guess, brush with a, you know, and, you know, an encounter, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, at the time, I'd like to think that it was. And I actually sought out the local, you know, Sasquatch investigator in Nelson, like a few days after that, and talked to him and found out all about the reports. And that's what really, it was that incident in Nelson that really brought the interest back to me into adulthood, after having been, you know, so into it as a, you know, child and as a, let's say, a young teen.
What's interesting about your book, In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, I'm going to ask you about the title in a second. It's not just about Sasquatch. It's about other issues too.
Right. Exactly. Well, so the book is set in a place called the Great Bear Rainforest, which is on the central and the north coast of British Columbia. It's part of the Pacific Northwest. It's an area the size of Ireland. It is located about, you know, starting about 400 kilometers or 300 kilometers north of Vancouver, between roughly the north tip of Vancouver Island and the Alaska Panhandle. And it's a place of small communities, very small communities, indigenous towns, and lots of resource extraction going on there. And, you know, British Columbia and Canada are very much sort of industry provinces, and the province and the country are both very industry dependent. And so,
sure.
in addition to it, the story being about my travels there, going from, you know, town to town, hearing reports and talking to the locals, there was also this backdrop of pipeline politics. You know, like there are pipelines that have been and continue to be slated for that section of the North Coast, and the residents there are opposed to it, and you know, there also stuff related to the grizzly hunt. So there's a lot of environmental issues and the history about the attempts to protect the area. The whole idea, the whole title Great Bear Rainforest is a name that came up in an attempt to, you know, protect the area. And there have been you know, agreements signed back in 2003 and also in, later in 2016 that have brought partial protection to the area, because it is this really, really beautiful, pristine, it's the largest you know, intact coastal temperate rainforest in the entire world. I mean, it's beyond even description, just how idyllic and beautiful. And it's a place where the ocean meets mountains and meets forest, and it's you've got high alpine, you've got glacier, salmon. It's I mean, the only places maybe in the U.S. or anywhere in the world that compare to it is maybe parts of the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, and perhaps like the Tongass National Forest in Alaska. It's an amazing place. So that was its appeal to me, is that I could go there, do a Sasquatch related book, a travel log, a travel memoir, but then you've got all of these other, you know, fascinating layers that you could weave into the story. And then, sure, you know, it's not then just a Sasquatch book, right?
Exactly. Now tell me about the title, In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond. It's a great title, but tell me about it.
Okay, so yeah, essentially it's essentially a title for the place. I mean, it's basically like the name that I have given to the Great Bear Rainforest. It is the name that I've given to you know, the abode of the Sasquatch. But in the story, I meet, you know, not to give the scene away, but I meet a local at a certain point in the story who, you know, who takes me to task on, you know, this quest of mine to, you know, figure out whether the Sasquatch exists or doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, man, you know, like, you know, it's not about that. And, you know, you're in the noble beyond. This is a place of magic and mystery and serendipity. And, you know, like you're in this magical place, essentially. And so, and I'm like, the noble beyond. And he's like, yeah, man, the noble beyond. And you get a lot of these characters in these remote places. And so, I ended up using that as the title, because it was at that point in the narrative when he, you know, kind of took me to task about this obsession to kind of, this almost dualistic obsession to, you know, exist, doesn't exist, I have to find out. It was after that where you know, I decide to steer the investigation into the Sasquatch in a different direction, into a more philosophical and, you know, journey to discover what it, you know, what the Sasquatch tells us about ourselves, and what is it, you know, why do we seek out the Sasquatch? And so, yeah, that essentially became the title of the book, pretty much.
And you're pretty well convinced that Sasquatch is the real thing, aren't you?
Well, no, I you know, I guess you don't get this a lot on your show, but I actually don't. I don't know if the Sasquatch exists or not. I mean, and I think that is the premise of the book.
But what are people seeing, John?
The premise of the journey, in a sense, is that I wanted to find out once and for all, you know, if the creatures do exist. And because, you know, after that experience in Nelson back in, you know, 98, I kept bumping, you know, meeting people or, you know, meeting acquaintances or friends of friends who've had these stories, and it did, and you know, going back to one of your earlier questions, it did, you know, this interest kept building later into adulthood and wouldn't leave me alone, and it culminated in a trip to the area.
All right, hold on for a second. Let's come back to that and talk more about this. And next hour, we'll take some calls on Bigfoot. And welcome back to our Independence Night program. Good to have you with us. We'll be back in a moment with John Zatta as we talk more about his work in the Valleys of the Noble Beyond. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. And welcome back. John Zatta with us. We'll take calls next hour as we talk about in the valleys of the noble beyond in search of the Sasquatch. And John, I'd asked you if you were a staunch believer, and you seem to be on the fence about that.
Yeah, well, I've never seen one myself, so I, you know, can't say with any certainty. But I mean, I don't think it's a preposterous notion. Obviously, I wouldn't have taken on the subject, right, you know, for a book. But I think, you know, since the trip and since the book, and you know, I came into contact with a lot of people who had, you know, really amazing, really, you know, fascinating experiences, and you know, people who live on the land, they know the animals there, the indigenous people. I mean, they're out all the time. They're out, you know, harvesting resources, they're fishing, they're hunting. They have, you know, bears, often grizzlies, coming into their communities on almost a daily basis. I mean, you know, the forest, nature is not some kind of other thing to them. And so, you know, when you hear some stories, I mean, they're not all convincing, but when you hear some that have multiple witnesses, you know, numerous adults at very close range for you know, where the encounters last a long time, and they're quite sure about what they've seen, you of course walk away going, you know, wow, like something has happened here. And you know, but at the same time, you know, I also know that, you know, humans are also, you know, we're masters of self-deception as well, and our minds are infinitely complex, you know, machines, and we don't perceive reality, you know, in all of its full spectrum. I mean, so there is also a lot of range for misperception and for, you know, seeing things that aren't there and hearing things that aren't there. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, I lean towards it, I think, for sure. And I would like for it to be the case. It's just, I'm just not quite there yet exactly, but.
But a lot of people are seeing something, right? Something.
Yes.
Who knows what it is exactly, but I mean, they're not all making these things up.
No, for sure. I think when you talk to a lot of people in the Bigfoot community, especially the more, I would say, you know, the flesh and blood sort of contingent, and maybe the more scientifically minded people, and those who are more skeptical, even though they also do lean towards it, I mean, they spend a lot of their time vetting reports, and often many or most of them end up being dismissed and everything. So, I mean, you know, if there is some flesh and blood reality to this, I know that there are other, you know, other theories, and but are you sticking to the more kind of, you know, the sort of man ape, or the kind of you know, humanoid type survivor from antiquity, whatever? When you boil them down, it would sort of kind of come to perhaps a small percentage, which would be worth considering or investigating further.
Absolutely. Now, you had a chance to also kind of investigate Native American communities.
Right.
What do they say?
Mm. Well, it's interesting.
Because they live there.
Yes. And they have long traditions and, you know, histories that go back, you know, thousands of millennia. And so, on the northwest coast of British Columbia, you have a number of different nations, and they tend to have a very similar, they tend to share similar cultures. There are slight differences, but you know, in the southern part of the Great Bear Rainforest, they have a creature known as the Junaqua and the Bookwist. And then when you go further up into, you know, Heltic territory in Balabala, they have a creature called the Slathla. And you know, the Books and the Sninik tend to then appear in Bella Coola. And so they're all different variants of the same creature. Some are smaller, some are larger, but more or less you tend to have in each community a smaller creature, which they sometimes refer to colloquially as the little people, and then the larger, kind of more classical, you know, big, you know, Sasquatch type creature. But what I found really interesting about going to these communities is that not everybody within the communities actually believes in the Sasquatch. It's I mean, you do have perhaps more of a percentage of those local populations that do because of their traditions. But because the young children were raised with these sort of scare stories to help keep them in line behaviorally, mm-hmm. when they grow older, they tend to not believe in the Sasquatch because they're like, oh, that was just a story that my parents told me to kind of, you know, frighten me and to make sure that I didn't misbehave. And so often when people finally do see one in the communities, they tended to have started off as not believing. And then they realize, okay, there is something to this, and it wasn't just a scare story. But you'd be surprised how many people in those communities don't really believe in it. And I think it's a bit tied, it's a bit more of an ego thing, because some people there spend so much time on the land and they never, ever, ever see one. And so in a lot of their minds, like non-Indigenous hunters and fishermen who go out, they say, well, how could there be such a thing if I've never seen one in my entire life? And so that tends to be the rationale.
Interesting take. The scaring of the kids is an interesting story, because that's what a lot of Anglo adults do and North American adults do, mm-hmm. To scare their kids. They come up with the boogeyman and things right. like that. Interesting.
That's right. And I mean, that is also partly the reason why when you visit these communities, a lot of people tend to be, who do believe in them, tend to be really, really afraid of them. And so, again, as you go from nation to nation, there's a slightly different disposition in terms of how they generally see the creature, those who believe in them. So in Bella Coola, for instance, I found generally that people had a more fearful view of the creatures, that if you'd seen one or come across one, it was malign. It can curse you in some way, or it could harm you physically. Whereas in the neighboring, Heltsik First Nation of Bella Bella, even though, yes, there is sometimes a bit of fear, I found that they tended to have a more positive relationship with the creatures, and that if you saw one, yes, it might be a startling experience, it might frighten you, it might actually, endanger you if you encroach too close to it, but to see one is kind of a boon or a blessing. It's meant to tell you something. It's meant to indicate that, it indicates that you've seen it for a reason, and it's meant to almost put you back on a straight path in life. And so the philosophical viewpoints about what the creature means changes from place to place. And I imagine as you travel to other regions of Canada and the United States, it probably also changes as well. So people generally tend to talk about Native Americans as if they were one big group and they all had the same view. But there are so many, so many differences and nuances. And even within one region, which is, one general area, you'll find a lot of differences.
Tell me a little bit more about the late John Bindernagel and his work, because he was pretty darn precise, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. So as part of my trip up to the Great Bear, I had to travel through Vancouver Island to fly from a town called Port Hardy to get to Bella Bella, because there's no roads up in the Great Bear. So I decided to stop in and see John, who was living at the time.
How old was he?
Well, he passed away last year in, I think, January 2018, and I think he was in his mid-70s.
Jeez. Okay.
And he was a wildlife biologist who did wildlife management work, and he's, originally from Ontario. He moved out to BC, and he, wrote a couple of, really key books on the Sasquatch phenomenon. One of them, which he called, I think, North America's Great Ape, the Sasquatch. And he believed, firmly, almost up until the very end, that the creature was essentially an ape, hence the title of his book, North America's Great Ape. And he took a very, very, very scientific, biological approach to the subject. And before he actually really got into the Sasquatch work, in the 70s, he spent some time abroad in Iran and in Kenya. He did a lot of international you know, work for the UN and that kind of thing. And he spent a lot of time talking with, you know, colleagues, I think at some primatology center in Kenya, who encouraged him to, like, take that subject on and to make it his thing, because he, for the longest time, he had no idea what he was going to specialize in as a wildlife biologist. And they're like, dude, make it the Sasquatch. Like, you know, mm-hmm. John was like, you know, it's amazing that these, you know, international people are there. They're not risk averse. And so he went and did that. And so I spent some time with him, and I've got a chapter devoted to him in the book.
What did you think of his theories?
I mean, I thought it was a very sober, safe, conventional approach that suited his personality, and perhaps why not, right? I think the debate has about what is the Sasquatch has moved so much in the direction of it being closer to a human that John took a lot of flack from his, you know, Sasquologist, let's call them colleagues, who really, you know, were like, John, come on, this is not an ape. This thing is a really intelligent creature. It's calculating, it's self-aware, it behaves as if it were a human that we're hiding from other humans, basically. And so John was like, oh, you know. And I think maybe at the very end, before he died, he might have begun to, you know, change his view on that a little bit. But what was really, really interesting about John, and this was the sort of theme in my chapter about him, was, you know, he had a chip on his shoulder, and he was really, really trying hard as he can to prove the existence, or at the very least to get the world to open their minds a bit to the possibility of the Sasquatch existing, because as a student in his undergrad, he was humiliated in one of his classes, because he brought the subject up in an auditorium of, I don't know, a few hundred people in a lecture, and, you know, the professor basically yelled at him and said, we're not talking about this. And so the students laughed, and they kind of, it was a really, really embarrassing moment for him. I mean, he told me the story in depth, and ever since then, his quest, his holy grail, wasn't so much to find the Sasquatch himself. His quest was to show the world, you know, like, was to vindicate himself, basically. And you know, it drove him absolutely insane that his own colleagues, you know, would poo-poo him about this. And he worked his entire life to try and get them to see it a little bit in his way. And he never truly succeeded.
What other kinds of lore, John, did you come across when you were doing your research?
So you have to bear in mind that this region is really remote. It's small towns. You've got a lot of, you know, fascinating characters, right, and a lot of history. You've got logging. You've got canneries. You've got all these old towns. And so, I mean, I met all kinds of people while traveling up there.
And all kinds of stories, too, I bet.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I'm getting at. And so, for instance, I met a fisherman. There's a lot of commercial fishing up there. This is the North Pacific. They're very rich waters, and during the summer, you get a lot of guys coming up there with their boats from all over, you know, the Canadian coast. And I met this one fisherman guy who he may have been like one of the top commercial fishermen who has been fishing, I think, since he was, you know, 12 or something. Like, he grew up in a family of fishermen and worked on some of the biggest and most profitable boats on the coast. And you know, I had a couple nights, you know, hanging out with him in Bella Coola, and he was just telling me all kinds of stories about how, you know, they would catch, you know, animals and sea creatures, basically, that they had, like, never seen before.
Wow.
And
Loch Ness monsters.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, they ranged from, you know, bottom-dwelling, you know, fish that he said were, like, you know, defied explanation in terms of their appearance, too. He had seen once, he claimed, with a colleague, they were a bit younger, younger adult, but he had seen off of the coast of Victoria this, basically, kind of like a sea dinosaur or a sea serpent, which I think nowadays goes by the name Cadborosaurus. I think one had washed up over a century ago on Vancouver Island, and he said him and his friend had been sort of swimming around their boat for the course of the day, and they'd seen it, like, seven, eight, or nine times, like really close up. And he said that there was no doubt in his mind that it was some kind of a prehistoric dinosaur type sea-going creature. And that was one, you know, story that stuck out. But there was like ghost stories, and I mean, even in one community that I traveled to called Wikano, which is at the southern end of the Great Bear, there were stories about a certain valley on the north end of a place called Owakino Lake, and people there referred to it as the Hoodoo Valley, and that was their kind of colloquial name for it. And nobody goes there. Everyone is afraid of the place. There were stories that go back to the mid-20th century about logging companies and loggers who would go in there to fell trees. But then all of this really weird stuff would happen, like the machines would all break down, and like there would be a high number of accidents and casualties.
Jeez.
And to such a degree that like the logging companies would flee one after the other from the area. Like they would actually have an incident that broke the camel's, like a straw that broke the camel's back, and they would just like run for their lives. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this could be like a Sasquatch related thing. But it turned out I spoke with an elder later who told me that, yeah, we know exactly what the deal is with that valley. You know, over a century ago, our elders did a ceremony because there was some kind of like bad energy, like mm-hmm. there were bad salmon runs and bad weather. And they took the energy and put it in the valley to hide it there to get rid of it. And
they moved it. John, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about your work in the valleys of the noble beyond. And we'll take phone calls, questions, and stories, too.